What else is important about October 31st besides Halloween? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this month-ending edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy, Barry Sheets. And along with me today, well, actually not right with me since we are doing this via remote, is my cohort and technical advisor and vice chairman of our Policy Institute, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, and it's good to be with you today, even though I'm not really with you. We're both, I think, in our respective libraries.
Exactly.
We're coming to you by the miracle of Skype.
Wonderful technology has brought us so many good things, including being able to tape these programs while we're sitting probably about 120 miles apart from each other.
Yeah, so if anything sounds a little funny from time to time, we have Barry's a little more rural than I am, so his signal is a little more spotty than mine.
And proud of it.
Yes, that's right.
Well, but today, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, is October 31st. And for the vast majority of the culture around us, that means Halloween, ghosts and goblins and witches and werewolves and vampires and you name it. But there's something else that happened on October 31st in our history that's actually more important to our culture than it realizes. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, on October the 31st, 1517, in a German town by the name of Wittenberg, a monk walked up to the door of the church in that city, and he had with him a document that he had labored over. He had written, and it were questions about how the church was executing the faith once delivered unto the saints. That monk, as many of you may know, was Martin Luther. And what he nailed to the church door was what's called the 95 Theses, 95 points of difference with the established church over the way they were handling doctrine and the propagation of the faith at that time. Now, why would anybody other than a couple of Presbyterians care about Reformation Day? Because that's what this really is. Other than Halloween, this is Reformation Day. This is the day that many of us celebrate the start of the Protestant faith. Now, really, it didn't totally get started right then on that day, but that was the linchpin. That was the kickoff point for the Protestant church. And if you are Baptist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Nazarene, I mean, listen, we can go down the list. If you are of a Protestant denomination, you trace your history back to that one monk in that little German city nailing that document on that door saying, I don't think the church is handling these things right, and these are things that we want to debate and discuss. Now, Chuck, as you know, that little act of nailing that document on the door created a firestorm not only in Germany, not only in Europe, but actually the ripples of it, the waves of heat from it, have changed the face of Western culture.
And honestly, that's not what Luther set out to do,
because not at all.
Luther's whole purpose was to correct an error in the church, and to actually, the way it was done was the 95 theses that he pounded on the door were in Latin, and they were put there for the purpose of issuing a challenge for debate between monks and priests and on these specific 95 issues. Now, what really happened in that case is really fascinating for those of us who are kind of technology freaks, because what happened was a printer who knew Latin came along, and he grabbed a copy of the 95 Theses, and he, unbeknownst to Luther, basically translated them into German and printed them up as handbills.
Yes.
And once that happened, it became an instant bestseller, basically talking about whether the church was discussing these issues. And among them were, of course, the issue of papal indulgences being sold to finance the construction of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And really, Luther had no intention of this going beyond the walls of the church.
No, that's true. He was a monk. He was under orders within the Catholic Church. and he wanted to correct those errors in the church. But the Protestant Reformation that actually he kicked off, well, somewhat unwittingly, actually looked that the doctrines of the medieval church at that time were drifting away from the Bible. That they were, then that practices, I mean, you mentioned indulgences, and there were some other practices that were going on in the church at that time that were not in keeping with a moral lifestyle. And so what they tried to do as this developed from Luther and down through the chain with Lutherans, with Melanchthon and others, and then over with the continental reformers, people like Theodore Beza, Martin Bucer, William Farrell, and then through him, John Calvin, who many people know about, but very few people understand.
Right.
They were trying to do something positive. They wanted that the church specifically in its practices would be specifically biblical, so that as the church spoke into the culture would hear the word of God and how it applied in all areas of faith and in life.
Well, it's interesting that Luther was terribly disturbed about the state of the church, the state of church doctrine, the belief structure that the church was drifting into. Luther was extremely concerned that the church's doctrines had very much disconnected from the Bible and what Scripture said, and were going off in a direction that was based on Greek philosophy and sometimes just the will and the whim of church leadership. And boy, you know, it's interesting in our day and age, here we are in the 21st century, we are now under 500 years. From the birth of the Reformation there with the Wittenberg Castle church. And the fact is that we have the same things going on inside the Protestant denominations. We have people who are basically concocting their own doctrines, not based on biblical revelation, but on personal revelation from all kinds of different sources, errant readings of the scriptures, sometimes just basically what I want the Bible to say. You have all kinds of phony belief systems creeping in, the emergent church. You have problematic theologies coming in with the federal vision, which sort of harkens back to one of the problems that Luther had in its more extreme forms. All kinds of different attacks on the divinity of Christ, you know, Unitarianism, that kind of thing that we see is so rampant in the church these days.
Absolutely. And I know our listeners, I mean, we're probably talking about some strains of things that they don't hear, but you've heard the emergent church. You may have not heard of federal vision. You may have not heard of some of these things. But there are numerous strains of theological error that come in. But what we want to talk about specifically today is how this act, almost 500 years ago, had such a great impact on how we're living today in the good old U.S. of A.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, absolutely. You know, what happened was it didn't just stay limited to a little area in Germany. And a matter of fact, it didn't just stay limited to Europe. I mean, as it moved and as the theology of the Protestants was developed more formally in the next 30 to 50 years after Luther's nailing of those theses and then the disputations that he had with the Catholic theologians over these issues, the theology spread and you went from Switzerland into Spain, into Poland, Hungary, Italy, France, Netherlands, Germany, all England, and then Scotland. And then in 1620, we had a little voyage that set out of some English separatists from Scrooby, England.
And by the way,
and then from Holland hitched a ride aboard a little ship known as the Mayflower. And in 1620, they sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, and they landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts, the Plymouth Colony, the start of what we formally understand as America today. I know that, you know, Jamestown and the James River Colony had started there first, but in 1620, when the Puritans came over, the Pilgrims came over, excuse me. If you haven't read it, I would suggest that you read William Bradford's book of Plymouth Plantation because it's available. But they talked about how they came in order to create a shining city on a hill and to apply the doctrinal truths of the Protestant faith in a new land where they were free to worship as they saw fit, and that they could, through their efforts and their work and their ministrations, create a free society. Now, Chuck, when we look at that, a lot of people, I think, in school, you've read a little bit about the Mayflower, you've read a little bit about the Pilgrims, but oftentimes we hear a lot about their interactions with the Indians over Thanksgiving. But we don't understand that what they really did was that they brought those changes, that using the Bible for all of faith and life, they brought that across from the European continent into the Americas. And that established and that settled in the New England area, you know, the first outreaches of the idea of holy commonwealth.
Well, one of the reasons that we know it, that the Reformation itself has such a profound effect on Europe, look how fast it spread. It spread like wildfire from 1517 until about the 1530s, about the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It spread like wildfire throughout Europe and had profound effects on European society in general. There were places that went instantly reformed, some places that fought civil wars over being reformed. There was a little thing called the 30 Years' War about 100 years after the beginning of the Reformation that killed a huge number of people in Germany, like a gigantic percentage of the population died from it. It's just astounding that it continued to have such a profound effect 100 years later, 200 years later, 250 years later, and now we approach the 500th anniversary of it, and it still is having a profound effect, despite the best efforts of those who would like to see it come to a screeching halt.
Well, that's part of the reason why we teach our Institute on the Constitution courses, is to help people understand that rich biblical heritage that was brought over to this land by the Pilgrims, that was established as the immigrations of, you know, the Scottish Presbyterians and the French Huguenots and others who left Europe because of persecution of their Protestant faith and came to these shores, how that developed through up to our founding fathers, who by and large were all Orthodox believers, the vast majority of them Protestants, and who carried that theology into the development of our governing document. You know, I'm sitting here looking at a book because I like doing that sometimes in my library, and it's one by a professor by the name of Archie Jones, and it's called The Influence of Historic Christianity on Early America. And he kind of puts it in a nutshell here. He says that, you know, consequently, its impact, and he's talking about the Protestant theology that was developed and brought over to America, says its impact was not merely religious in the narrow sense, but cultural. It impacted not merely the church, but also evangelism and missions, the family, education and learning in general, science, political thought, social thought, law, economic life, politics, rhetoric, and culture as a whole, because it sought to transform all areas of culture to biblical standards for the glory of God.
And I hate to bring this to an end, but we are way out of time, so we will continue the discussion tomorrow at 5:30.
And be with us.
And now, here's a constitutional moment with the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
G.K. Chesterton once commented that the United States of America might be the only country ever founded on a creed. Well, based on my reading of the founding documents, I would have to agree with Chesterton. There is a religion, a creed, undergirding this great American experiment in self-government. It's expressed in the Declaration, and its political expression goes like this. God exists. God created man. God is active in the affairs of men. Our rights to life, liberty, and property come from God. The God-ordained purpose and obligation of government is to protect us as individuals against threats to these rights. Government, as the protector of these God-given rights, must not become the force which threatens that which it is designed to protect. If government stops being the friend of these rights and becomes the usurper, the people must undo it, throw it off, abolish it, and form new government which will follow its charter. These are the purposes of our government. Notice that they do not include any idea that the purpose of government is to bail out the banking system, or to provide health care, or to provide education, or to protect the environment, etc. While these things are desirable and doable by others, they are not in the scope of the government's job description. even if government could do them well, which it can't. It has no authority to do them at all, if it tries. It becomes the enemy of God-given rights rather than the protector of them. This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View.